Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're going to talk about the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and in the context of a new book. It's called UNC A to Z, and it contains more facts about the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill than I think that's been compiled in any short book, and in such a fashion that makes it easy to read. But its subtitle is What Every Tar Heel Needs to Know About the First State University. And the authors of the book are the university's libraries, the university's archivist, Nick Graham, and his colleague, the university's former historian, Cecilia Moore. And these heroes put this book together. Welcome, Nick Graham, and welcome, Cecilia Moore.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us, Cecilia, where did the idea for this book come from?
It came from Nick, and it was originally his idea, and I'll let him sort of explain that part. Let him do that part.
Okay. Sure. I mean, it originally came out of my work as a reference librarian in the North Carolina collection in Wilson Library. Which has just such a wealth of reference sources about North Carolina. I was inspired by and got to know Bill Powell a little bit, his work, the Gazetteer, the Encyclopedia, the Dictionary of North Carolina Biography. And, you know, we use those all the time and, you know, had access to clipping files and other resources. And it struck me that it would be so valuable to have something like that for UNC, because we really did get the same kinds of questions coming up over and over again about building name origins, about, you know, historic firsts, you know, major figures and events on campus. And so I've been, you know, thinking about this for a while. And then, you know, after I started working in the university archives, really delving into university history, it became even more apparent. And that, you know, it was around that time that I was, you know, Cecilia was working as a university historian. We were collaborating on a lot of things. And, you know, I think from, you know, Cecilia's perspective, she was hearing a lot of the same things and recognizing this need at the same time, but just from a different perspective.
So can you remember the moment when you all first talked about writing, collaborating on this book?
I can.
Do you remember, Cecilia?
Yes, I do. You asked me, you said, I have this idea for this short encyclopedia about UNC, and I'm thinking about asking other people to help write it. And I'm wondering if you might be interested. And I said, well, send me a description of it and what might be going on with it. And so Nick sent me a short prospectus he had written up along with some sample entries. And it seemed to me, much as he said, exactly the kind of book we needed, because we often answered those questions over and over, not just for students, but for administrators and different people who had an interest in the history. So I said, yes.
Well,
I would be happy to help.
And then how did you then divide up the work to attack all of this information about Carolina?
We had a spreadsheet which listed all the entries. And so first, I think we divided it up. We took the ones that we knew a lot about already. And then we each took ones that we thought would be kind of fun to do. We kind of picked those. And then we had a bunch left over. And so then we just divided those up and tackled them.
Who came up with the idea of doing this alphabetically? This provides a way that you can get to it, but it's not chronological and it's not topical. It's just alphabetical. Was that your first decision that the organization would be alphabetical?
Well, I think we had always thought about the encyclopedia type model, so alphabetical there. And this was something that we talked a lot about with UNC Press. They wanted to explore some different arrangements, maybe topical, something like that. But, like I said, as someone who loves reference books, I love kind of just how fortuitous it is to find, you know, I just opened it and I saw like an old picture of Forest Theater next to students rushing Franklin Street because those fell together alphabetically. So that kind of fortuitous, you never know what you're going to find because it's not strictly chronological, I think is it really contributes to the, for me, the fun of the book.
Well, let me ask you both this question. You've said that this came about because both of you were called upon to answer questions from a variety of different sources, part of your job to be able to come up with it. So what was your favorite question when people would ask you what you do and you say, I'm a reference librarian and I get a lot of questions. And they say, well, what's the one that you remember? What's the most entertaining question and answer that you had?
I've always been amused by some of the student traditions. And, you know, one of the ones that would come up a lot, you know, undergraduates would always be fascinated by this, would be the tradition of college students streaking in the 1970s. And so that was one of my favorite just kind of trivia questions that UNC very briefly held the national, maybe the world record for mass streak when nearly 1,000 students streaked through campus in 1974. So those kinds of things I always thought were a lot of fun to see students rediscover and to be able to share with people.
Cecilia, did you have a most memorable question that would be entertaining that's on your list when people ask you what you did?
Let me think. You know, people oftentimes the kinds of questions I got that were fun to try and explain to people is, what really is our founding date? Were we founded in 1789? Mm-hmm. Or 17.
Are we the oldest? Are we really the oldest university?
Are we really the oldest? Are we really the first? And so that I learned, that helped me, having to answer those questions a lot, made me able to get to a short, quick answer.
What is the answer to that question?
What
is the oldest state university? Is it Carolina? Is it Georgia? Is it William & Mary or some other public university?
The University of Georgia was chartered first by the Georgia State Legislature in 1783, and UNC was chartered in 1789. However, Georgia did not open until the 1800s, the University of Georgia. So UNC was the only publicly chartered university to graduate students in the 18th century. We had our first graduating class in 1795. William & Mary is 100 years older than UNC, but it started out as a private school and only became part of the public university system in Virginia much, much later.
Are there other contenders other than those two, Georgia and William & Mary? Anybody else raise their hand and claim to be the oldest public university?
Not really. There's nobody else making that claim. University of Georgia makes the claim too. They call themselves the first state
they
university
do, yeah.
as well.
How it always puzzled me that how can you claim to be the oldest just because you had the idea, which is what Georgia seems to is. Yeah, we decided we would have it, but we didn't have it, but we claimed to be first.
I've heard someone saying that's like celebrating your wedding anniversary, you know, the day you proposed, or celebrating the wedding anniversary the day you got your license, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, they had the plan, but it took them much longer to get started.
Right.
Yeah, it's almost as if they said, well, we thought of it first. We had the idea first or something like that. What difference does it make with Carolina to be first?
That's a great question. And honestly, I think that's a question for administrators. I think that, you know, the university is eager to celebrate first. But, you know, I think, you know, you see much more of an effort to celebrate being the best or being the most effective at something. And certainly we see that in a lot of the bragging about rankings and things like that. But yeah, that's a great question.
All right. Well, I'm glad I finally got to ask a great question, but I shouldn't have because it's taken us a break time. If you joined us late, we're talking about the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill and some of the interesting facts about it. It's compiled in a new book by University archivist Nick Graham and former university historian Cecilia Moore, both of whom are guests, and the three of us will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a new book that's called UNC A to Z, What Every Tar Heel Needs to Know About the First State University. And I'm visiting with the book's authors. Nicholas Graham is the university archivist. And Nick, you've got an important temporary position too, aren't you? You're the curator, aren't you?
I do. I'm the interim curator of the Southern Historical Collection, just an amazing collection in Wilson Library.
A gigantic job. Well, sometime come back and let's talk about that job, which
I'd love to. Yeah.
And Cecilia, you are no longer, but the wonderful former historian of the university, the university historian. So these guys. Both of these guys, because of their roles, were called upon to answer factual questions about Carolina, and they've assembled some of the answers to the questions in the book, UNC A to Z. And let me ask you this. I've asked you what your favorite question was. What is your, Nick, what is your favorite entry? What, when you flip through, you flip through the book, which is the way, fun way to read it. What are you really excited about when you flip to a page that you say, I really like this fact or these facts or this story?
Oh, that's a great question.
And you don't have doesn't have just one of the favorites.
Sure.
One of the favorites.
Sure. I think some of the ones that address more recent history are fascinating, because that was, you know, some of the ones that are more challenging to write. So, for example, there's an entry on Carolina Hall, which was the building formerly known as Saunders Hall. And so that one really, you know, just for the amount of time it spans, talking about its origins in the 1920s, why it was named for William Saunders, and then going up into pretty recent history, the student activism that led to its Saunders name being removed.
That's really funny. I thought that was going to be Cecilia's answer, I thought, because she was kind of surrounded by that. But tell us, you picked it up. Tell us the story. This is... most of us just know that there was a Saunders Hall and now it's Carolina Hall. That's probably the most. What's the story?
Well, sure. Saunders Hall was one of the buildings built kind of during a building boom in the 1920s. And it was, you know, right on Polk Place. And it was has been the home of the history department originally. And now it's home to, I think, religion and geography. and a couple other small departments. And it was named for William Saunders, who was revered on campus and across the state for his work as a political leader and editor and historian, and is widely known to have been the leader of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina and hugely influential in its resurgence in the state. And students had been, you know, drawing attention to this for decades, for Saunders' leadership of the Klan and the fact that there's a building honoring him with the name. And students, you know, became especially active in about 5 or 6 years ago, really, you know, pushing hard and gaining a lot of support and have Saunders' name removed. And they were lobbying to have it named for Zora Neale Hurston, who spent a little bit of time on UNC campus in the late 1930s. And Cecilia can talk about that. Cecilia wrote about that in her dissertation and later book about the Carolina Playmakers. But this was in what was a surprising move to some people who'd follow UNC history. The Board of Trustees acknowledged Saunders Klan leadership and voted five years ago to remove the name. The students were disappointed when they did not choose the new name Saunders Hall, but just named it Carolina Hall. So, you know, in the entry, we talk about the building use as an academic building. We talk about Saunders, then we talk about the student activism and the eventual renaming. So, you know, that's the kind of one that spans, you know, most of a century and, you know, it's a challenge, but it's a fun challenge to summarize in a short entry.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I had a question that sort of relates to this topic, because this is important discussion. You know, it's almost like the kind of case that you'd have in a class, to because mm-hmm. you're never really sure exactly what the right answer is. But then the other problem is that events keep rolling. And so you write about the trustees' action to name one building, and then at the same time they said, well, we're not going to do any more.
That's what
the book says, but things have changed. I mean, how did y'all feel like when the trustees made your book not up to date? Tell what happened? What happened? What did the trustees do? And how are you going to – well, this might be in the revision, the second That's edition right. of the book. I talked too much.
Hopefully it will be in the second version. yes. We knew the whole time writing it there were certain – that we would reach a point where we couldn't keep updating things, that the manuscript would have to go to the printers, and that things would be out of date even from the time we finished the manuscript to when it got published. So we have a running list of updates and new entries that we will add to another edition.
Do you have some recently the News and Observer put out a list of the favorite eating spots in the Triangle, including a number in Chapel Hill that have gone out of business during the COVID crisis, either for that reason or for others. Are there other things that have changed on you that you will want to address in the second edition of the book? Any favorite eating places? Any favorite other places?
Oh, any favorite eating places? Things that I think still deserve a little more attention than we kind of gave them in the book were things like the local music scene more so. Mm-hmm. We referred to it, but I think that we could do a lot more with it. We could probably do something more with the whole local food movement and the involvement of UNC people in that. Too, and I think that would be another good.
Well,
and that was always a real challenge, was how much to write about Chapel Hill, because the history of the town and the university are so intertwined. But you know, we're not trying to write a book about Chapel Hill, but of course, there's going to be overlap.
Well, what are some of the exceptions where you have to talk about the community that surrounds the university as a part of it? The music scene would be one of those. Restaurants, you didn't emphasize restaurants too much, but you did have a couple of...
We've got a places. Few, yeah. We talk about the Rathskeller, Carolina Coffee
he's
Shop.
He's not here.
Yeah.
Right.
He's not here, yeah. I mean, Cecilia wrote a great entry on Chapel Hill, on the town of Chapel Hill. There are... You know, there's an entry on Franklin Street. So, you know, really just kind of the few kind of businesses and locations that are most student centered, we included, because it would have felt incomplete to not have those in there.
Much of that was because of, you know, our focus. I think our audience, really, when we were planning it and writing it, was people who, alumni, who would have memories of different Chapel Hill things, right? But also students and new students who would look to kind of look up things that would be part of that student experience.
Well.
Mm-hmm. And so that kind of drove our decisions about how much we would talk about Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you joined us late, we're talking about a new book, UNC A to Z, What Every Tar Heel Needs to Know About the First State University. We're talking to the authors of the book, Nick Graham and C. Warren. All three of us will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and we're talking about it in the context of a new book this year, a UNC A to Z, a sort of encyclopedia presentation of various facts about the subtitle of the book is What Every Tar Heel Needs to Know About the First State University. And we're talking to the authors, and they're telling us some more about what we need to know about their book, Cecilia Moore, who was the former university historian, and Nick Graham, who was the university's archivist. And y'all, welcome back. I told you during the break that I'm interested in legends that develop about institutions and memories that get enhanced, I guess, about events. And are there any legends about the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that are important to its history?
Nick, go ahead.
Well, I can. Yeah, one of my favorites is the legend of Hinton James, who was, you know, we know that he was the first student at UNC, and he was the entire student body for 2 weeks.
Well, he walked.
The legend of him walked.
Yeah, he walked from Wilmington.
That's the legend. Yeah. Well, that's the legend, is that he walked. And so I spent some time, you know, just trying to go through the records and asking, like, how do we know that? How do we know that he walked? You know, where did that story come from? And I couldn't find anything. We've got Hinton James wrote a letter in the 1820s, you know, remembering his time at UNC. And so he talked about other people on campus. He talked about some of the professors. He never talked about how he got there. And so I started tracing it back through the different histories. And the earliest I could find it was like in the 1920s, where they talked about him trudging all the way to Chapel Hill. And after that, that was kind of turned into Hinton James walking all the way. So we still don't know exactly sure how he got there. He came from a wealthy family. You know, in my opinion, I think he probably rode a horse. He probably may have had enslaved people with him. So the legend of this lone student, you know, walking, some of the legends say he walked with his dog all the way from what's now Pender County. There's nothing definitive that we can prove that, but that, you know, if you wanted to make that argument, there's nothing to disprove it either. So I just think that's one of the most interesting legends that has emerged without any clear reason of where it came from.
Well, this is interesting because this has always been a powerful, I've always loved this idea of this student, in order to get to the university, walked all the way. And here you've done some research, and it's sort of like when I go to Bart Ehrman's religious class and he says, well, the children of Israel didn't walk all the way from Egypt to the Holy Land. They, you know, it's just impossible. There's nothing left. Or, you know, be skeptical about this. And so it's hard to pry my pride in some of the legends. And, you know, I guess one part of university education is myth bursting. And you guys are lining up to do that.
I will say, in Hinton James' credit, it still would have been an incredibly difficult journey. The roads were not good. It was a rough winter. So he went through great efforts to get to Chapel Hill and deserves all the credit for that.
Well, you know, it raises the question, and too much to be addressed probably, but I'm curious, and that is how the word got out that there was a university and what time, you know, when does school start? Whether or not in researching the question of whether or not he walked, understood how he might have, in his own letters later on, how he heard about it, how he decided to come, and how he felt when he got here. There were no other students here.
Well, there were ads in the newspapers, and there was, you know, this was a school that was set up, you know, really for the elites in North Carolina. So I think, you know, there was a pretty large group of board of trustees, and so they would have shared information in their local community. So I think, you know, word would have gotten out. You know, and his letter that he wrote talking about his early time at UNC, not a lot of details, but he acknowledges that he was the only student here for a couple of weeks, and it must have been a pretty kind of roughshod scene with just the one building, one or two buildings in place.
How do you alphabetize this, the walk of Hinton James? Is it an H or is it a J or is it a walk? In the A-Z.
We talked about that, I think, in the entry for the Hinton James dorm when we were talking about it.
Yes.
And so that would be under H. That would be under H's then for the
right
for the
right.
First. Lots of questions about your book. You assigned Cecilia to talk about the Gingul legends. What did you learn about that, Cecilia Moore?
The Gingul Castle and the Order of the Gingules. There, their origin story is based on this legend that a student named Peter Drumgoole, I think, died or committed suicide. He disappeared mysteriously in the 1830s, perhaps of a broken heart. And there's been many legends around whether his ghost can be seen in and around Ginghul Castle and different things like that. And we have a short entry about it, but of course, Carolina alumnus E.T. Malone Jr. has written a whole book about what he thinks happened to Peter Drumgoole, which does a whole lot to kind of explain some of those mysteries.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I would point people to the book to learn more about what Malone thinks actually happened to Peter Drumgoole.
What is, I think, the most striking thing that most of us who drive around that part of the Ginghul area and see this castle. I mean, and that would be, if I were a visitor to town, that would be my question. What in the world is a castle doing in the middle of a town? I mean, it's a real castle.
It is, or it certainly was built to look like a real castle. And it belongs to the Order of the Ginghuls, and they use it for their meetings and events.
Well, it's a secretive.
I didn't go to undergraduate at Carolina, so I have never been inside it. I don't know much about it.
Well, there got to be some mythology that we can develop about the castle, and maybe for the next book I'll have an entry for you on that.
Oh, good.
I wonder, one of the things that people who love Chapel Hill remember, they all have their favorite people. And one of the questions I had was, who's the most admired, the most favorite person that you write about in your book, UNC A to Z? Who's at the top of the list?
Well, that's a great question.
Well, is it Frank Porter Graham? Frank Porter Graham?
Okay.
At least if you'd asked this question 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, that would probably be the answer, but maybe not today, or would it be? Who are the contenders for the most memorable person?
Well, I mean, I think if you're talking about, like, public figures, I mean, certainly Frank Porter Graham looms large, Bill Friday, Dean Smith would be kind of maybe the big three that people...
Michael Jordan, maybe.
Michael Jordan, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And Roy Williams, interestingly.
Others, yeah. Other people, any extraordinary teachers whose memory hangs on as a legacy in Chapel Hill?
I think Horace Williams is somebody who, you know, a lot of people cite for his teaching and influence.
Why?
Cecilia's written a lot about. That's a good question. That's the kind of thing that I don't know. I mean, he was, you know, we don't have videos and we don't know exactly what he was like in the classroom, but his students, Thomas Wolfe was one of them, just talked passionately about how he engaged his students. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that I think it's hard to understand how great of a teacher somebody was if you're not in their classroom.
All right. Well,
but you can tell by the influence they had.
Well,
I think another couple of people who still, I think people remember as being very influential were Albert and Gladys Coates.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. What's the story there?
And that's still... Well, Albert Coates was a law professor who founded what became the School of Government, initially the Institute of Government, and now the School of Government, to help train state and county, state level and county and local officials when they come into office. And it's a tremendous service to the state and has done very well. And Gladys Coates, even though she had no real official title, I think, was very influential in helping get that up and running and helped it succeed through the years. And they are very fondly remembered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I live near where the current School of Government building is. And think of Albert Coates and Gladys and what North Carolina would have, how it would have been different, the whole state, not just the university. But the mm-hmm. story, you know, the great story, and it's too long to get into in your encyclopedia, was the tension between Albert Coates and the university, because the university wasn't always 100% for what he was doing for the state. And it's a remarkable and wonderful story. Gosh, we got to take another break. If you joined us late,
okay.
I'm visiting with the authors of a new book, UNC A to Z, What Every Tar Heel Needs to Know About the First State University. The authors Nicholas Graham and Cecilia Moore are with us, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Cecilia Moore and Nick Graham. They're the authors of a new book, UNC A to Z. It's a nice, easily read and wonderful book. Gosh, great holiday present. The subtitle is What Every Tar Heel Needs to Know About the State, the First State University. And again, Cecilia and Nick, thanks for writing the book and thanks for joining us.
You
had some special challenges because you're writing this book during some great moments of university history. Tell us about that.
That's true. I mean, we were inspired to write the book in part because of so many questions that people approached us with about university history. But this was also a time in which there were many different issues and controversies going on campus related to that history. And I think probably the most prominent one is certainly the Confederate monument, which we all know as Silent Sam. And a monument that we had to do a lot of research about, but we also had to do a lot of talking about, and there was a lot of interest, rightly so, in it. Nick, do you want to talk a little more about you did to make that history accessible?
Well, just to show how long we've been working on this and how things were changing. When we wrote our first draft of that entry, the monument was still standing. So we revised it after the statue was toppled. We revised it again after the base was removed. And this was something that, you know, I think the end of the entry says something like, it continues to be at the center of discussion and debate about Confederate memorialization, because, you know, we knew that things would continue to happen, you know, as we talked about earlier, even after this was published. But I think one of the things that was important for us was to really tell an accurate history and really place this as a monument that doesn't just, you know, memorialize soldiers, but that really makes a political statement that places it right in the heart of the white supremacy political movement in North Carolina. And that was important to be able to tell that story accurately. I think there's a lot of older campus history that portrays it just as a war memorial. And, you know, based on our research and those of many other scholars at UNC elsewhere, that's simply not true. So, you know, this is not, you know, an overtly political book in many ways, but it was really important to tell accurate history. And that's something that I think we both, you know, it's a challenge, but we both felt good about doing it.
It turns out, didn't it? Excuse me. Go ahead, Cecilia.
Mm-hmm. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, for me, it was that this is another example of the painful experience that the university has leading the state. Going back mm-hmm. to the time of the speaker ban law, where the university had to mm-hmm. take an uncomfortable lead on an issue which is resolved and it's really in its favor with the public that free speech is more important than keeping communists out. And then with respect to the toppling of Silent Sam and that Confederate monument, which was a very painful, for me, a very tough kind of thing, because the state law obviously was designed to prohibit that kind of action. Mm-hmm. And I was, if not a participant, an approving observer of what was going on when I'm, you know, sworn to uphold the law. But after Carolina got its statue down, statues started falling all over the state. With the same rules were applied, but people said we just got to get rid of them. And it was to me a dramatic change. And mm-hmm. am I right that it was, if not started it on the Carolina campus, the major statewide discussion sort of really got started with that? I mean, it was important, not just for UNC, but yeah. for the whole state.
Well, I mean, the one in Durham came down first.
Right. It's true, but true, but not.
I would say that of all of the more than 50 Confederate monuments, I'm going to get that number wrong, mm-hmm. in the state, that Silent Sam probably generated the most attention.
Yeah.
And the most debate. And so it tended to be the center of any conversation about them, about any mm-hmm. disagreements about what Confederate monuments might or might not mean. Silent Sam was really the one that seemed to be the one that most people cared about and were focused on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
With all due respect to the 3 Confederate monuments that were on the state Capitol grounds.
Right.
Well, I
think that that's, you know, so I think, and it is important to kind of keep in mind that even after the dramatic events of the last 9 months, there are still a great many Confederate mm-hmm. monuments up in North mm-hmm. Carolina. Mm-hmm. Only a handful have been taken down.
Mm-hmm.
On another important current issue, you do not cover, couldn't have covered the COVID, COVID thing, but you did.
Right.
You do cover the flu epidemic of mm-hmm. of 1918 mainly. And my question is, the flu epidemic, which killed a lot of people too, was it as important or more important than the COVID epidemic on the Carolina campus currently? Any comparisons?
If we are, you know, fortunate enough to be able to do a second edition, you know, that's one of the top of our list is writing about the COVID-19 pandemic because of how just incredibly transformative it has been on campus. I don't, the flu pandemic, My colleague in the University Library, Sarah Carrier, has done a lot of research and presentations about this. And one of the points that she made was just how easy it was to kind of shut down Chapel Hill and the campus. You know, there was not a lot of movement, you know, around the state, you know, even internet, you know, UNC campus now, we have people arriving from across the world every day. You know, just because of how small and relatively isolated it was, the idea of kind of closing it off, the campus was under quarantine, that was possible in a way that it's just not now. And it was so much smaller, but it still had a huge impact. 2 university presidents died from the flu. The student body, I think, from what I understand, came out better than other similar size groups in other parts of the country, but it absolutely had a tremendous impact on campus.
Well, there's so much more to talk about, but real quickly, for each of you, 30 seconds, what did you leave out that you found out that you should have included now that you've been out talking about the book? Cecilia, first, what kind of entry would you like to slip in there? It's okay to say we covered everything.
I think at the moment I feel like we covered everything.
That's great.
Though,
that's great.
There are things I would like to write more about.
Nick, how about you?
Is
there an entry you'd add?
We intentionally left out some things that have been well covered elsewhere, like athletics and some others. I think, you know, just real quickly, I would include an entry about the campus police. I think there's been a lot of questions about that. And I would maybe do a little bit more about the history of the hospitals. I think there's more to be said there that we could cover.
Well, guys, y'all, thanks for this wonderful book. I think the thing that if I were critiquing our program, we haven't made it quite clear how much fun the book is. It's not just tome. In fact, its cover shows you that this will be a fun book to read, and you can pick it up and just open it almost any place, and you'll learn something new about an institution that's important to all of us. So thanks, Cecilia Moore, and thanks to you, Nick Graham, for writing this book, and a special thanks for you taking some time to talk to us about it today.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
And, of course, thanks to all you all who are listening. Just remember that I'll be back here before you know it, and I hope you join me then.